This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If you were to get your 40 million people vaccinated by the end of the year, starting in about April, you'd need to vaccinate about 148,000 a day.
That's Professor Guy Richards at Wits University talking about South Africa's coronavirus vaccination plans. Details coming up. Also, scores of blind people protested yesterday in Cameroon to mark World Braille Day. And Central African Republic President Faustin Archange Touadéra has won a second term in office. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Scores of blind people protested Monday in the Western African nation of Cameroon to mark World Braille Day and call for more books and teachers who can use the system of touch reading and writing for the blind. Blind and visually impaired people blame the lack of Braille books and teachers for their lower levels of education. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
41-year-old Jean-Pascal Somlingom lost his sight to a measles attack when he was 8 years old. Lingom says since he became blind in 1998, nothing much is changing and little attention is paid by the government to visually impaired persons in Cameroon.
There are about 600,000 people in Cameroon who have visual impairment and about 150,000 who cannot really read with their eyes. I don't think that we have up to 2,000 that are able to read the Braille. We need to make this writing and reading method more popular. And one of the ways is teaching Braille in teacher training institutions, because they are the channels through which knowledge is conveyed to a people.
Braille is a code that uses bumps and indentation on a surface to represent letters, which can be recognized by touch. The system was invented by Louis Braille, a French man who was blinded in an accident at a very young age. Somme is president of the Association for the Promotion of Assistive Technologies and the Education of the Blind, the organizer of World Braille Day activities in Cameroon. He says his family helped him learn Braille and continue his education. He is now advocating for more assistance to blind people. During their protest meetings in the capital Yaoundé and the economic hub Douala, blind demonstrators said the Braille system helps them further their education, establish their independence, and reduce the need for support. They said the lack of education keeps them poor and dependent on their communities, NGOs, and well-wishers. They said they believe some misconceptions about the blind, such as the belief that their handicap is divine punishment for some wrongdoing, will cease if they have access to Braille for education. Evelyn Angonwi is vice president of the African Union for the Blind. She says Africa has more than 6.5 million blind people and more than 20 million visually impaired persons. She says 90% of the blind and visually impaired are illiterate because they either lack Braille or teachers who can read or write Braille.
The African Union of the Blind is encouraging member countries to promote this system of writing amongst the visually impaired. This special system of writing has come a long way to remove visually impaired people from illiteracy. And of course, reading and writing is the only way to gain education.
The World Blind Union estimates that there are over 180 million blind and partially sighted persons in 158 countries. Celestine Kombo is the official of Cameroon's Ministry of Social Affairs in the coastal city of Douala. He says the state will not abandon blind people even though the government has limited financial and human resources.
Le gouvernement invite certains enseignants qui ont déjà certaines connaissances sur le braille.
He says during official examinations, the government invites teachers who have a knowledge in braille writing to translate questions from blind learners. He says when blind learners write using the braille, the government still invites examiners who master the system of touch reading and writing to correct scripts written in braille. He says Cameroon has no government institute that trains people in braille writing. He says the state created 68 schools where both visually impaired and children who see study with emphasis on braille reading and writing. World Braille Day is annually celebrated on January 4, the birthday of Braille founder Louis Braille. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News. Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Some of South Africa's prominent medical professionals have rejected their government's reasons for not having the COVID-19 vaccine available in the African nation's hardest hit by the pandemic. More than a million people in South Africa have been infected and more than 30,000 have lost their lives to the coronavirus since March 2020. The country is part of COVAX, the International Vaccine Acquisition Procurement System, but that will be able to provide only 6 million shots to South Africa in 2021. This has locked the government into negotiations with vaccine manufacturers. Darren Taylor reports.
The government says it doesn't have the COVID-19 vaccine yet, because it couldn't afford to gamble on prepaying for vaccines that could have been ineffective.
That's obviously nonsense. It's a cover-up.
Guy Richards is Professor of Critical Care at Wits University.
The ordering system or the mechanism that had been developed in order to order these vaccines allowed people to pay at a later stage if and when the vaccine became available and if and when it was shown to be effective. So this was actually prior to the development of the vaccines. It's complete and absolute nonsense that there would have been money lost at that time as well.
Dr. Aslam Dasu of the Progressive Health Forum says many countries of similar and even lower economic standing than South Africa began negotiating for vaccines with potential manufacturers 6 months ago.
Even Kenya is expected to receive vaccine by the end of this month. Egypt, Morocco, Costa Rica, Peru, Uzbekistan, it's all over the world. Countries have done this.
Dasu says South Africa shouldn't be in this position.
We have it from pharmaceutical manufacturers that a couple of them had approached the government but were spurned, saying that we are going to only obtain vaccine from the COVAX facility.
COVAX says it'll only be able to help South Africa in March or April. The government's also been criticized for not securing a batch of the world's first COVID-19 vaccine made by Pfizer when it was approved almost a month ago. The state says it didn't make sense to order the shot because it must be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius, and there are only two facilities in South Africa able to keep medicines at such a low temperature. Richard says this isn't an excuse.
There are developments in terms of companies that would be able to supply freezing systems for a certain amount of the Pfizer vaccine. And at least some of the vaccine could be sourced from Pfizer and could actually be kept at minus 70.
In the context of the state's failure to get relatively speedy access to vaccines, says Richards, its aim of injecting two-thirds of its people this year appears to be impossible.
If you were to get your 40 million people vaccinated by the end of the year, starting in about April, you'd need to vaccinate about 148,000 a day. And I'm not sure that we actually have that capacity currently.
The government says public and private health facilities will cooperate to make sure the target's reached. Its focus now is on trying to buy vaccines from four pharmaceutical companies. But if deals are not signed soon, says Dasu, South Africa will face a disaster entirely of its government's making. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Central African Republic President Faustine Archange Touadera has won a second term in office. According to provisional results from the country's electoral commission, Touadera won 53.9% of the votes. In second place was Anicet Giorgis Dolgoli with 21%, and Martin Ziguli came in third with 7.4%. The results must now be officially validated by the Constitutional Court, which will field appeals. News reports say the vote and its aftermath were marked by violence and the formation of a rebel coalition amid calls from the opposition to delay the election. President Touadera has blamed former President François Bozizé for the electoral unrest. Bozizé has denied the allegations. He took power in a coup in 2003 and ruled until 2013 and now faces an international arrest warrant for crimes against humanity and incitement of genocide. As the festive season ends, South Africa's government is relying on the military and police to block the return of thousands of undocumented Zimbabweans who work in South Africa. Arigando gives us more on the story.
South Africa has been working to reduce the delays in processing documents at its border points, including the Beit Bridge entry point. Months of coronavirus restrictions and the need for COVID-19 certificates has created long hours of congestion at the crossing into Zimbabwe. In addition, the South African government is trying to stem the flow of illegal immigrants from Zimbabwe returning to jobs in South Africa after visiting their families at home. To address both problems, the South African government has sent the army and additional police to the border point. While visiting the border point recently, the South African Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi said hundreds of Zimbabweans have been arrested.
The army puts the number at about 500 people every day.
For weeks, traffic has nearly halted at the Beit Bridge crossing, the main point between South Africa and Zimbabwe, as officials and drivers struggle with proper documentation required as part of efforts to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Traffic at times is backed up more than 10 kilometers on both sides. And there are reports that at least one freight driver died waiting to cross the border because they could not leave their truck for help. Ngabuto Mabena is the Zimbabwean Community in South Africa Association president. He says the problem for the illegal immigrants needs a diplomatic solution between the two countries and that the Zimbabwe government needs to reduce the cost of getting a passport, which would make it easier for Zimbabweans to cross the border legally.
Is for the ANC to review its friendship with the ZANU-PF. The ANC must be honest to ZANU-PF that it can't continue with its friendship when the majority of Zimbabweans are putting pressure on South African social services. This is why we have the whole minister going to patrol the borders. But they are not addressing the elephant in the room by patrolling the borders. Because even if you patrol, you don't patrol. People always find ways of coming in.
Mabena says the Pretoria government needs to push Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF to address the country's economic problems and reduce the need for thousands to leave home to work in South Africa. Observers such as Mabena say the illegal crossing compounds the COVID-19 situation. Both countries are now in the grip of a second stage of cases.
On reflection, one would say maybe it was a mistake. We did not really anticipate that there was going to be that huge volume of people crossing the border going home for the holiday. Had we taken that into account, we should only have opened the borders in February when people were back at work.
Zimbabwe has been in a long economic decline caused by a variety of factors, including drought, corruption, and poor administration. There are estimates that there are more than a million of Zimbabweans who have gone to neighboring South Africa and Botswana to work over the years. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madabouli said that President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has directed him to start a transition into a modern, civil, democratic state. Said Sadiq, a professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
Well, it's significant, of course. It means a great deal for Qatar, and it means a great deal for the Gulf states and their partners as we confront Iran. One of the paradoxic effects of the blockade of Qatar was that air flights were not able to transit Saudi airspace to go into Qatar. And so they had to go through Iran, which means that Iran got paid overflight fees. So, you know, the blockade was undertaken ostensibly to deny support to Iran, but it had this effect of putting over $100 million a year in the pockets of the Iranian regime. But look, it's important. There's a new administration in Washington. It's going to reassess our commitments around the world. And it's very hard to say we should be committed to a group of small states, none of which are democratic as we understand it, who can't even cooperate amongst themselves. So this is a good step forward.
The summit is held 3 weeks before confronting a radically different U.S. foreign policy towards the Gulf region, and President-elect Biden is inclined to revive the JCPOA with Iran and a possible scaling back of U.S. military presence in the Gulf. How would that impact the summit focus?
Well, it's certainly in the background. I think it lends a sense of urgency to what's going on. But I think it's a little bit of a mistake to assume that the American position will radically change. Biden wants to go back to the JCPOA, but this, you can't go back to 2016. The situation's different. Iran will not just say, okay, let's go back to where we were in 2016. They're going to ask for additional concessions. They might ask for compensation for economic damage that they've suffered due to U.S. sanctions. That's all a non-starter in the West. So there will be a reassessment, but it really is remarkable when you look at the U.S. Footprint in the Gulf and U.S. action in the Gulf and in the broader Middle East, it's pretty resistant to ideology. And a lot of the folks on the Biden team were involved in the Obama policy, which looks a lot like Trump policy in the region. So having a change of administration might concentrate the mind a little bit, might lead urgency to some needed reforms. But fundamentally, America is in the Middle East because it enhances our security interests, and our security interests don't change just because we have a different president in power.
The incoming president ran on a platform of confronting GCC states over their appalling human rights records and curbing American military support for the Saudi and Emirati intervention in Yemen. What can we expect from this summit?
Well, I think the summit will have a statement of the predations committed by the Houthis in Yemen, and it will highlight the Iranian support of it. I think that this is going to be a point of contention, and it's not an easy one. You know, the Obama administration supported the initial Saudi Emirati intervention in Yemen. As the war went on, I think a lot of the opposition to it was not so much concern about Yemen as it was opposition to a policy that Trump embraced. So it's really an anti-Trump vote. Now that Trump's gone, some of that impetus may go away, but there's still going to be a fight. And I think what the GCC states will do is make a solid statement as to what their interests are and what their concerns are in order to have a strong negotiating position going forward with the Americans.
That was Saeed Sadiq, a professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, discussing this development with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. France has arrested the head of a former rebel group in the Democratic Republic of Congo on charges of complicity in crimes against humanity. The French news agency AFP reports that Roger Lumambala, a former opposition lawmaker, is accused of leading an armed group. United Nations investigators accused the group of carrying out extrajudicial killings, rapes, and cannibalism during the country's civil war from 1998 to 2002. A UN report in 2003 first pointed the finger at Lumumbala, who became a minister in his country's transition government between 2004 and 2005. DRC authorities accuse him of treason and complicity with the M23 rebels. He denies the allegations against him. Government and UN forces defeated the rebels in 2013. The French judiciary has the right to arrest and prosecute suspects in crimes against humanity cases committed abroad. Growing violence and insecurity are increasing the threat of hunger and infectious diseases in Mozambique's northern province of Cabo Delgado. Aid group Doctors Without Borders say conditions are deteriorating every day as desperate population hopes for assistance. For more, we have VOA's Chinedu Ofor speaking with Louis Ottavio, project coordinator of the group.
Now here in Cabo Delgado, the situation is very serious, very dramatic, because the number of people displaced by this conflict in Cabo Delgado is increasing. We have nearly 500,000 people displaced in the province. So the needs also are increasing, because these people need the basic things like water, sanitation, even shelter for their tents, food and medical care.
Are you facing any fears or challenges of infectious diseases?
Ourselves, as international volunteers, the infectious diseases like the COVID pandemic now, and also malaria. For the beneficiaries, for the people, for displaced people, they are more exposed to disease because of this lack of good conditions. So they are living in tents, so they don't have water. They are exposed to cholera, to watery diarrhea. They are exposed as well to malaria. And of course to COVID, and also desnutrition. Desnutrition also is a problem here.
There are reports of challenging security situations. Can you tell us about it?
The security situation, it's also difficult in the north cities, because now I'm based in Pemba, in the capital. It's the south of province, so Pemba is relatively safe now, I can say that. But the cities in the north, like Mocimboa da Praia, Macomia, and this Kisanga, this area in the north, the conflict is still there, and the people, they leave the area, and they try to come to safe, to come as a safe area in the south of province. So this is what I can say about security. So here in Pemba, we are not facing security issues, but the province, yes, there are a lot of conflicts.
How challenging is it for your organization to meet the needs of these thousands of refugees?
Very complicated, because UNICEF has, despite our efforts that we do to provide an answer, we have only a small portion of that we can address to these needs, especially not only UNICEF, but I believe also the other organizations. We need more supplies, more fundings, more human resources to respond to these needs. So we also have a very huge area to cover, from Pemba to Montepuez, that's another district. It's a huge distance to cover by only one organization.
Has any group or government responded to your calls for more assistance to these people?
Well, we try to work with the government as well, but as I told you, the crisis is huge, so it's difficult to respond in the right proportion to this crisis. That's why I was saying that we need more attention. I invite the international community to join us to recognize this conflict as a humanitarian problem, and also to help to respond it.
Now, how bad can things really get if there are no response to your request?
The situation is very complicated. Now also we are starting the cyclone season, the storm seasons, the rainy seasons. So these people will be more exposed to these storms, to cholera, to diarrhea, to lack of access, because their movement is more complicated in this area. So the situation will be really bad, and the people might die in this situation.
What are the areas of the greatest need?
To be honest, the needs are everywhere. But in the north region, where the conflict is still there, we know that there are people there in need, but we don't have access.
That was Louis Ottavio with Doctors Without Borders speaking with VOA's Chinedu Ofor. The Associated Press reports that for the first time, a Sudanese film will be among the Academy Award contenders. You Will Die at 20 tells the story of a young man whose early death is prophesied not long after his birth. The movie, based on a short story by Sudanese novelist Hamour Ziada, will compete in the International Feature Film category for the Academy Awards, the highest film honors in the United States. The film was produced amid mass demonstrations by mostly young people against Omar al-Bashir. The military toppled Bashir in April 2019, ending his nearly 30 years of rule. Critics are saying the movie demonstrates that Sudan's cultural scene is reawakening after decades of oppression. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.